one of the last things that you said piqued my interest, which is, how do we reconcile the various viewpoints of what fundamental freedoms are between the various communities?
It is undoubtedly the case that different religious traditions emphasize different values. So radical Islamism will always emphasize social solidarity over and against personal freedom. However, most countries have subscribed to things like the United Nations Declaration on Human Rights. And in my dialogue on fundamental freedoms, for example, with Al-Azhar al-Sharif, the premier place of Sunni learning, the question for my Muslim interlocutors is, what is the basis for freedom of expression, for freedom of belief, for freedom to manifest belief, and freedom to change belief in Islam? That's the question for them. And they are taking a lot of care to answer that question. So 2 years ago, the Grand Mufti of Egypt, Sheikh Ali Goma, issued a fatwa as a result of many years of scholarly work in Al-Azhar, which said that apostasy was not punishable in this life, in Islam. This was a very progressive and brave thing for him to do. As you might imagine, he immediately came under furious attack for saying this. And as a result, and regrettably, he had to retract much of what he had said. I'm sorry about that, but also I understand why he did so. So the dialogue is not one simply of progress. I mean, you have progress, but you also have setbacks. When President Khatami was the president of Iran, he's a very close friend of mine, and there was the possibility at that time that the Islamic Revolution would take a progressive turn under his leadership. When he first became president, he wrote an article about the spiritual foundation of the United States of America. And I remember thinking to myself, would President Bush, who was then president, of course, be able to write a similar article on the spiritual foundations of the Islamic Republic of Iran? And of course, the answer probably is no. But that spring of Khatami's presidency did not last, and Khatami himself regards his presidency as a failure in that respect. So again, what seemed like progress was halted and even reversed. But nevertheless, we have to persist, even in the most difficult circumstances. When the Iranian Majlis 2 years ago, I think it is now, passed the law prescribing the death penalty for apostates, many Christian groups broke off contact with the regime. And they asked me, through an intermediary, whether I too would break off contact. And I thought about it and prayed about it. And then in the end, I said, no, I would not break off contact. But I would insist that this matter was on the agenda for any meeting. You know, these are the kinds of prudential decisions that you have to make in these circumstances.
You mentioned a few moments ago that the Sharia law would be a disaster. Can you sort of expand upon that?
Yes, I thought somebody would ask that. The point is that the assumption behind much of public law in Western societies is Judeo-Christian. But still, yes, that's another point. Yeah, that's a good point, because that is also eroding very rapidly. However, the assumptions of the Sharia are quite different. So If you acknowledge Sharia in terms of public law, I mean, on the one hand, of course, Muslim communities must have the freedom to live by their own religious law. That is not the question. The question is whether that should be recognized in terms of public law. Every religious community has its own rules for living, and it's part of religious freedom in any society for them to be able to do so. The question is whether this should be recognized in terms of the public law in any particular society. Now, the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Lord Chief Justice in England, for example, who were urging that Sharia should be recognized in some way in terms of public law, gave the example of Sharia family law as one of the areas that could be recognized in this way. Well, could it? That's the question. Let's just look at what would happen. In most Western societies, I'm sure Canada is no exception, bigamy is a crime, isn't it? Is it a crime here? Well, would it be a crime only for some people then and not for others? See, this is already happening in Britain anyway, that polygamous relationships are being recognized through the back door in terms of social security provision, for example. Secondly, in the provisions for divorce, for instance, in Western public law, the parties are treated equally, man and woman. This is by definition not the case under Sharia. And whatever rights women have, please do sit down, I'm sure you will have an opportunity. Whatever rights women have by petitioning the courts for divorce, they're not the same as men. The custody of children. At the very time, as the Lord Chief Justice in Britain was arguing that Sharia family law should be given some recognition in terms of public law in Britain, the law lords were having some of their last sittings because they have now been transmuted into a Supreme Court. Not a development that I favored, but anyway, that's how it's happened. And I was sitting with them when this decision was made because a bishop has to lead prayers before they can deliver their decisions on these appeals. And the appeal was of a Lebanese, Muslim Lebanese woman against deportation to the Lebanon. And the law lords ruled that to deport the woman to Lebanon would be a violation of her human rights because her son under Sharia law would be taken away from her and given to her former husband. Now, you know, which way are we going to go? The Lord Chief Justice is saying recognize Sharia family law. The law lords are saying this would be a violation of this woman's rights. This is also true of the laws of evidence, which are not equal, whether for non-Muslims or for women. The laws of inheritance, which are also unequal. So the point is that if you introduce something that works on different assumptions, on different presuppositions, you have introduced a principle of contradiction in the system of law. I mean, that's my main reason for saying it should not be recognized in terms of public law, whilst, of course, religious communities, whoever they are, should be free to practice their faith and the rules for observing their faith in any way that they see fit. However, it should be clear that everyone, whoever they are, whatever their faith, should have access to the courts for redress of grievances and equal protection as citizens of any country.
Yeah, in the light of the analysis that you gave us on the relationship between Christianity and Islam over the many centuries, and also with the increased emphasis today on interfaith dialogue, do you think it's appropriate for the Christian community to continue to conduct missionary efforts in Islamic countries and to try to convert Muslims to Christianity?
Well, the Muslims are trying to convert Christians to Islam. both religions are, this is what I was trying to say in my relationships with the Tablighi Jamaat in Raiwin, both religions are by their nature missionary. And it is best to recognize this rather than to deny it. And to say, of course, you must be free to conduct your missionary work, we must be free to conduct ours. That's the question. Muslims are free in most countries where Christians have any say at all to conduct their missionary work. But Christians are not free in every part of the Muslim world. That's the question. And that becomes then the question about reciprocity, how to promote fundamental freedoms wherever Muslims or Christians have a say. The obligation for Christians, just as for Muslims, is to invite people to faith in Jesus Christ for Christians, just as for Muslims it is to invite people to Islam. I don't want either side to compromise on this fundamental commitment. But even if you recognize this fundamental commitment on each side, that still leaves a lot of room to work in cooperation for the good of the community, for the recognition of fundamental freedoms at the international level, and so on.
Just a little addendum here. I don't see how that's possible if we continue to try to
This gentleman was first. I asked him to sit down, but he was first.
Yes, no, I think
can I just make a little addendum to my question? Yeah, I don't see how that's possible if we continue to try to attract each other into our own faith communities, and all these faith communities have come from the Abrahamic origins. So how can we work together? And how can we have interfaith dialogue if we try to, steal each other's sheep all the time, so to speak?
I don't subscribe to this kind of undifferentiated Abrahamic religions idea. It is quite possible to say that whilst all these communities take the name of Abraham, in fact, their understanding of Abraham is quite different. For the Jews, the Abraham is the sort of physical ancestor, if you like, at least in theory. For Christians, Abraham is an ancestor in faith. For Muslims, Abraham is the first Muslim. So there are differences even there. And I don't think that anything is served by glossing over differences. This has been the mistake of the past, that people have thought that dialogue meant that you somehow arrived at a kind of lowest common denominator that all could agree. That is not what dialogue is about. Dialogue is about appreciation of difference. It is about accountability. It is about establishing a world order where people have the freedom to believe, to express their beliefs, and indeed to change their beliefs if they so wish to do.
Go to this microphone and then come back to my colleague here.
So when I walked into the Christian church, that force, if you will, that from my childhood welcomed me home, I didn't feel at home in Mecca. I didn't feel at home in Riyadh. I didn't feel at home in the different mosques that, we were taken to as a child growing up in Iran. So, and I have heard wonderful, wonderful stories about other Christians that I met through my line of work who have said they've had visions and encounters of Jesus. And so can you please share some of your experience?
Well, thank you for that. Before I come to the particular case of Iran, a general observation that the teaching of the Bible is that God has not left himself without witness anywhere. So that all people, wherever they may be, have some sense precisely of that providence of the one who has created them and who has a destiny for them. So it is entirely understandable that you had this sense, as all people should if they were open to it. it is also the case that the Bible and subsequent Christian tradition speak of Christ as the fulfillment of all authentic spiritual aspiration. So in Ephesians 1, for instance, Jesus is spoken of as the anakephaliosis, as the recapitulation, as the bringing to a head of all that God has willed for us. So again, if you felt that you had been led to your home, that is entirely in accord with Christian belief and tradition. What I think you haven't said, which needs to be said, and I'm sure you would say it, is that it is not just a question of coming home or fulfillment or a recognition of an initial providence, but it also has to do with a deep assurance of safety, of salvation, if you like, which is part of this experience that you have. Now, coming to Iran particularly, I think Iran is unique in this, that a very large number of people in Iran, whether they are Muslims or not, have powerful spiritual experiences. And very often, Jesus is part of this experience. I don't know why this is. Whether it has to do with the particular psychology of the Irani people, their background, what has happened since the revolution to them. But it is a fact, and I think it is a fact that has to be taken into consideration. I mean, the fact of the matter is that more Farsi-speaking people have become Christians since the revolution than has ever happened in history. And that is true both in Iran and outside.
I want to thank you for a very illuminating talk. I really enjoyed it. And I do not know if I have a question, but I do want probably a few clarifications. First is about Sharia law, and second one is about India and Pakistan participation. Western democracies are constructed with an inherent faith that individual is the sole constituent when it comes to political considerations, that political values and all other values have to be determined or allocated by the state on the basis of individual rights. And that is inherently in tension with the Sharia law, which takes community as its foundation. So do you think that Western democracies should reject Sharia law on the philosophical ground that individual, not the community, is the basis of their foundation first? And regarding India and Pakistan, like, I'm not sure, but if I recollect it correctly, probably you tend to suggest that the division of India and Pakistan was more culturally inspired rather than religiously inspired. If that was so, then that would be very, very problematic, because when you look at the map, then East Bengal and West Bengal, they were very close culturally, speaking Bengali, and very, very close. Likewise, Punjab, and so the geographical difference was huge. And so it was, you know, it would be extremely, I find it extremely problematic to consider it as a cultural division rather than religious, because it might be a political move to divide the country on religious ground, but religion was probably the fuel that did it. So I would like to hear your thoughts on both these. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, thank you for those questions. Very, very interesting one. I was talking about it this morning to the students that in the emergence of Western polities, there has been a balance, or at least a search for a balance between what is known as the descending theme, which is how polity is organized, and the question of religious, of individual freedom. I don't think that Western societies have finally solved this problem. I think it remains a problem, as I think you are also suggesting. However, the question of human dignity, of equality, of liberty, these are fundamental issues that relate to the person. And they have developed in Western societies directly under Christian inspiration. And I hope that Western societies recognize this, because if the Christian basis for them is cut off, then these values also will erode and disappear, as indeed we are seeing in some respects in the West. My own experience, apart from theory, is that when I am in the Muslim world, I busily promote personal freedom. When I'm in the West, I remind the West of social solidarity, because I think that's where the lack is. And that's not contradictory, because one thing is needed in one part and another in another. On the India-Pakistan thing, I'm not justifying what happened. All I'm saying is that the Muslim nationalists wanted a homeland for Muslims where they would be free to live according to a culture that had undoubtedly, and to some extent, been formed by Islam. But religion was not the dominant feature. Muhammad Ali Jinnah was not a practicing Muslim. And many of the leaders of the early period were not, and many subsequent leaders were not. Zulfiqar Ali Bhutto himself. And to some extent, the whole thing was driven by a mistrust of Hindus, that in a united India, the Hindus would not allow Muslims political space. And this is why I think the rejection in 1946 by the Congress under Gandhi's inspiration, even to provide for a system of separate electorates on a basis that might be reviewed in due course. That was the immediate cause of partition, although there is a hinterland to it. So I think what I would say is this, whatever the religious factors may have been, is that the program was not theocratic. And Jinnah went out of his way in his speech to the Constituent Assembly to say that non-Muslims would not in any way be second-class citizens. He refused to privilege Islam or Muslims in any way in that early period. Now, of course, that didn't last, and Jinnah's early death and so on resulted very quickly in a theocratic direction that the state took already in 1951 with the Objectives Resolution, which set the tone for what was to come. But periodically, there have been attempts in Pakistan to go back to Jinnah's vision. And in fact, there is a very powerful movement today to undo the kind of Islamization of the country and to go back to nationalism, to Muslim nationalism, rather than Islamic theocracy. Now, for outsiders, this may be a distinction difficult to appreciate, but it is a real distinction. As I say, many of the Christians in what came to be Pakistan supported Muslim nationalism because they felt, they also felt that to deal with another minority was better than dealing with the overwhelming Hindu majority. Again, that may have been a miscalculation, but that is what happened. Since then, of course, both in what is now Bangladesh and what remains Pakistan, religion has become much more a major player. And so when we look at the situation now, it does seem to us as if religion was the dominant issue. I think that is because the Islamists have triumphed, certainly in Pakistan and increasingly now also in Bangladesh, to provide that kind of shape to the life of those nations. But in the beginning, even with Bangladesh, Mujibur Rahman was a nationalist. He's not a theocrat in any way whatsoever. So I would still maintain that there is some use in making a distinction between Muslim nationalism, as in Turkey or in the Arab world or in Pakistan, and Islamism, theocratic Islamism.
Bishop, I think with your permission, we'll take one more question. I think I saw John working his way up to the microphone there. And there will be opportunity to approach the bishop at the reception afterwards if you have questions or comments. So one final question, John, and then we'll have thanks for the bishop's address.
Thank you for this very thoughtful and far-reaching talk. My question, you mentioned the Judeo-Christian assumptions behind democratic legal structures. The question has two parts. One is, have these civic legal structures strayed away from these assumptions to an extent such that most judges today, most legal experts today, either do not appreciate or do not understand these assumptions, or, for that matter, render structure inconsistent or unworkable. Part B is, should they stray away from these assumptions?
Should what, sorry?
Should civic legal structures in, you know, democratic countries aspire to change their assumptions, given the reality of a multi-faith, multicultural milieu in Canada, England, America, States? Should they aspire towards some other kind of assumptions that are more neutral?
Could you give me some examples of what neutral assumptions might be?
Well, exactly. This is exactly the point.
The assumption of neutrality by secularism is an assumption that must vigorously be challenged, because there is no such thing. I mean, what, you know, you have a choice. You have a choice between one set of assumptions and another. You don't have the choice between neutrality and the Judeo-Christian assumption. I mean, this is something that has to be said as clearly as it is possible to say, because this lies at the root of so much of the malaise that there is in so many Western societies. I think that's the first thing to say. The second is that, yes, there is, I think, ignorance, not just in the judicial and legal community, but much more widely than that, about what is the basis, for example, for upholding human dignity. I mean, what the move that has been made by the radical enlightenment is to say these are ultimate values. But why should we have any ultimate values at all? I mean, if you follow naturalist assumptions, as promoted, for example, by Richard Dawkins and the other gurus of our world, then there is no reason at all why human beings should be regarded as special. And so philosophies like that of Singer that accuse anyone who in any way regards human beings as especially privileged as a kind of, what's his word, speciesism. So killing mice to save babies would then not be allowable, because mice have the same value as babies. I mean, this is the kind of confusion that has been caused. So human dignity, inalienable human dignity, can only be upheld if you have some kind of transcendental value to undergird it, which in most Western societies, ideas about human dignity have arisen because of the belief that human beings are made in God's image. Similarly with equality. I mean, I was saying this morning to the students that there is a great equality industry around. But how has the idea of equality actually arisen? It has arisen because of the Bible's teaching of common origin. Common origin. Out of one blood hath he made all the nations of men. And this doctrine of common origin in my lifetime has been challenged by scientistic racism. That has tried to use evolutionary theory to promote the idea that the different races are unequal because they have different origins. You see? I mean, it is still possible to do. Thankfully, genetics has come along and confirmed the instinct of the Bible, that human beings indeed are equal because they have a common origin. But it is no good for the judicial community to uphold values if they know less and less about where they have come from.
I'd like to invite to give thanks on all our behalf Dr. John Patrick, the president of Augustine College, and fresh from recent debates with Peter Singer, of all people, to come and give thanks.
When Professor Blomquist asked me to do this, after the end of the lecture, so that I had no idea that I was going to be expected to have paid some attention, I wondered what his motives were, and I didn't pursue that too far. But of course, a lecture such as the one we've heard this evening will not be easily forgotten. It is stunning to listen to someone review 14 centuries of history in such a clear fashion and to send you away with some structure. Quite an incredible performance, even more so because he apparently needs no notes. That's real learning, and I hope none of us will forget it. Thank you, sir. It has been a pleasure to listen to you. However, this is only the first lecture in the series. We hope you're coming back for the next ones, because there were at least a dozen lectures en route on the way through where you sort of dangled the lecture in front of us and then moved on. The last few minutes are a good example. The nonsense of moral neutrality is indeed the disease of our world that was recognized a long while ago by Alan Bloom and most importantly by McIntyre, names that clearly have had a huge impact on you as well. We thank you for putting your erudicity at our service, and we hope that we can make some use of it, and please do come back again. Please join me in showing your thanks in the usual way.